You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coy O'Neill and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. There are three kinds of people in the world, and I think I'm generally comfortable with this categorization. There are people who have never heard of or only dimly aware of Calvin and Hobbes, most of whom were born after the late 1990s. There are people who love Calvin and Hobbes, and there are joyless monsters who hate everything good in the world. Joining us today on the show, we have two people who may or may not be joyless monsters. I don't know yet. Joshua Herring, a dean of students at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. Joshua Herring, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Coyle. Thanks for having me on the show.
And are you a joyless monster, or do you think Calvin and Hobbes is great?
I love Calvin and Hobbes. I took one of my favorite honor seminars at Hillsdale College was actually a study in comic books taught by the late Dr. Donald Turner. And he gave me a few tools to appreciate comics, but it was mostly a gathering of fellow comic book lovers. And we would chat about comic books for an hour a week. And part of that class was on Calvin and Hobbes. That was really my introduction to Calvin and Hobbes. Somewhere between then and now, I've read them all once or twice. They are fabulous. I love them, and I'm so glad we get to talk about them on the show.
Yeah, I, which is interesting because I would not rank them as a comic book. Maybe we can come back to that. Also joining us today is Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. Jordan, how are you doing today?
I've been doing good. And can you be a joyless monster and love Calvin and Hobbes?
No. This is the litmus test.
Okay, then I am not a joyless monster. I think there might be a fourth category you should include, though, that is even worse than the joyless monsters, and that is the people with the Calvin peeing stickers.
Oh.
I was about to say on a truck, because it is almost always on a truck.
Or a hat or a t-shirt, I suppose. But what do you mean the sticker is on a truck, or like Calvin is peeing
on a
truck?
Well, the sticker is usually on a truck, and he is usually peeing on some other brand of truck.
Right.
So I would put those in the, you know, if the people who just don't like Calvin and Hobbes are in the eighth circle of hell, the people with the peeing stickers are down there in the frozen lake of Cocytus, or however you pronounce that.
You could definitely spin that as a sort of treason. I mean, I'm sure Watterson would see it as a subset of treachery, since he fought so hard to keep artistic control of his characters, and to see it put to that use has to be just terrible for him.
Yes, and I think I meant to run this down, but I have seen a quote attributed to him. I don't know where it's sourced, and I don't know who got him to say this, because he just doesn't give interviews, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But he said something apparently off the cuff somewhere about how he underestimated how much people would want to see Calvin pee on stuff. So go figure.
And Jordan, how did you first encounter Calvin and Hobbes?
Oh,
tell us about your personal relationship with Calvin and Hobbes.
Well, a class on comics at Hillsdale sounds amazing. I have not had even a modicum of any kind of formal training, though. I love Calvin and Hobbes because at some point, I'm not even sure how old I was, but I remember my parents going somewhere and bringing me home the first Calvin and Hobbes collection that was just called Calvin and Hobbes, and has them flying off of a dock in their wagon over a pond, and that. Maybe we'll come back to this more, but the kind of semi-rural setting of a lot of the comics, I was raised in the woods, and we had, in fact, a pond in our front yard with a dock on it. So I'm sure that had the vividness with which I could imagine myself in those scenarios has something to do with that love. But, I mean, I just ate it up, and I had the Lazy Sunday book. I had a few other collections. And then as an adult, I got that amazing massive 3-volume complete Calvin and Hobbes. So I don't,
about 80 pounds or something. I mean, it is a beast.
It's huge. I made the mistake, because I had it in storage. I made the mistake of trying to carry it and the complete Far Side at the same time, which is a very good workout. But, yeah, so, I mean, I don't even know how old I was. I was apparently old enough to read. So, but, you know, as a kid, this would have been 30 years ago when it was in the middle of its run. I remember when it stopped, which was a sad day.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was, you know, I read my books over and over again. I would go to friends' houses, and if they had a book I didn't have, I neglected my friendship and just sat there and read that. And then every Sunday when we went to my grandparents' house to eat, the first thing me and my cousins did was pull out the comics section, Charlie Brown, Garfield, Calvin and Hobbes, Far Side. Like, that, those were the go-tos. And two of those have held up really well. Well, Charlie Brown is just, like, rock solid. Far Side and Calvin and Hobbes are amazing. Yeah, I don't know how much we want to compare Watterson to other comics, but...
I mean, there's... what he's doing is so different from anyone else, right? I mean, there are some comics that later would kind of be in his style, but they were definitely in his style. So I think of, like, Get Fuzzy is kind of my go-to as a, this is something that's doing generally what Calvin and Hobbes was doing, although not as well. It's good. It's just not as well. Yeah. And Pearls Before Swine would be another that I tend to go to.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was reading some of the essays we read for the – well, we had the one essay we'll probably talk about, but I read several other. I found a couple of interviews with Watterson and a really great essay from the LA Review of Books, which is a pretty detailed and very fair comparison of the kind of generational differences between Charles Schulz and Bill Watterson and the way they approached the comics business. Right. It's I'll send it to y'all. It would be worth including in the show notes. But at some point in there, Watterson talked about how a lot of comics are just oversimplified, no scenery, just characters slinging puns at each other. And Pearls Before Swine is interesting to me because sometimes it is literally that. But there's also this weird self-awareness to it where they're calling attention to the fact that all they're doing is doing puns. And so it's kind of coming back around. I was trying to fit Pearls Before Swine into the categories I was kind of thinking through as we were preparing for this. But I've just loved Calvin and Hobbes my whole life, but as a amateur, basically.
Right. Yeah. And no, I'm in the same position. I didn't read it when it was in the newspapers, in part because the newspaper only came out 2 or 3 days a week or once a week. I don't even remember now because we lived in a rural community and that's how they roll. That's still how they roll for that matter. So keeping up with it in the papers really just wasn't much of an option. And I mean, our papers usually came through the mail, so they were always a couple of days behind.
Yeah.
But those collections, my parents, I don't remember being given it, but they did at some point. I do remember going to the state geography bee because, you know, that's the kind of kid I was in middle school and finishing up with the geography bee. And my parents let me pick out something from the University of Wyoming bookstore for the 6.5-hour drive back. And I picked the latest Calvin and Hobbes collection, which I think was There's Treasure Everywhere was the title of it. Which I think was the first of the new format. Not to get too much into the details here, but if you have not the omnibus with all of them in it, but if you have the older collections, there are distinct differences between the regular books that are sort of square, the weekly strips, the collections that combine two of the regular books, and the treasuries, which are kind of large rectangles, upright rectangles, and then the after he wins his battle with the syndicate, the later rectangles, which are horizontal rectangles, and none of them fit very well on a bookshelf. I've been a fan for a long time, and going back and rereading stuff for this episode kind of reminded me that this is great art, and I'm sad that he's not making it anymore. But I'm also glad he didn't keep making it until it got bad. I can appreciate that too.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something about the respecting the really the life cycle of a thing, in this case a comic story. I mean, Calvin can't really stay a child forever. I mean, I think it and to confine it to just those, I forget how many years, but to like 4 or 5 years, 6 years, where it's he's writing those as a daily, a weekly strip. But it really sort of preserves the effect, I think. But it's I find it hard to read the strips like Garfield. I'm like, this cat has to have died like 20 years ago. But he's still doing the same old fat cat jokes, the same, oh no, Monday's coming. Like, there's nothing new. But Calvin and Hobbes, I mean, Watterson manages to keep it fresh. He keeps it exciting, and he does kind of keep some of the same themes going, and he builds on them. But it's a fresh iteration. So I mean, I think there's something really impressive. Jordan used the word artistic integrity, I think, before we started recording. But I think there's something about respecting the strip as an art form to really close it off before it hits that redundancy point. And that's really to Watterson's credit.
Yeah. Well, the idea for this episode came when I saw something go by on social media in one of the I don't remember which one of the groups I'm in, where someone had asked a question about whether Calvin and Hobbes was appropriate for their 6 to 10 year old. And my default response was, well, of course, that's certainly when I encountered it. And who would ever say no? And there was a lot of back and forth, not between me. I stay out of these kinds of conversations in those sorts of groups, because who knows where they're going to go? Who knows who's going to get canceled down the road as a result of anything said there. Several of the strips that were pointed out as inappropriate were the one where Calvin's at home in bed sick watching the daytime soap opera. And it's the people talking about having the affair and murdering their spouses. I'm assuming we're kind of all on board with, yeah, this stuff's fine. But before we get into themes, anything we want to mention about the appropriateness of the content? Really, I just want to have my chance to say, yeah, it's perfectly appropriate. There's nothing wrong with it. But I also want to make sure I'm not crazy here.
If you're offended by cartoon butts, every once in a while, Calvin runs out of the tub and streaks through the house. Some people get real bent out of shape about that. I mean, we had, what was that book, Wacky Wednesday? My elementary school had Wacky Wednesday, and somebody had gone through with a Sharpie and given the guy black boxer shorts, you know, in the shower. So if you're in that mood, you'll want to take that Sharpie and go through maybe a Calvin and Hobbes collection. I can only remember like maybe one time that happened, but and then Calvin's fantasy worlds, and I think this is the best thing about the comic. Are, you know, I mean, they are elaborate, over the top, dramatic, violent in a sense, you know, cartoon fantasies of T-Rex is eating people, and, you know, he blows up his school with an F-14 Tomcat, and or maybe it's an eagle, I can't remember. And, you know, but these things are so over the top that I can't imagine being such a joyless monster that you would not want your kid to read that.
Yeah,
I did. I did think I noticed some things differently reading it now, kind of from the lens of a teacher. I mean, I've had moments teaching in a classical school where I have had to censor the classics in a way. I don't know if either of y'all run into this problem as parents, but it is almost impossible to find a children's collection of Greek mythology that's published prior to 1980 that's not filled with naked people. I think that's perfectly legitimate if you are accurately trying to represent the classic myths. Like that is part of the classical world. But there are times like I'm like, nope, it's not good for me to spend too much time thinking about naked people. That's not a good thing. As far as like Calvin and Hobbes goes, though, and I don't think there's a problem with appropriateness there, except like, you know, and Jordan, you mentioned the naked butts. There was at least one other one where I thought there was a very realistic kind of conversation between Calvin and his mom where Calvin, this couldn't have been referencing Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, but it sounded like it was, where Calvin comes out and is like, hey, mom, why do people do X, Y, and Z? And it's in the context, he's clearly referencing like some torrid affair that had been kind of detailed on the nightly news. And it's a commentary on kind of our own cultural desensitivity to these kinds of things. But I think what Calvin does over and over is he interacts with the world as a snarky six-year-old boy does. Now, he's obviously an adult's picture of a snarky six-year-old boy. But at the same time, I've been to friends' houses. Their kids run around naked all the time. It's a normal thing for small children to run around naked. It's not – it takes time to civilize children and teach them they have to wear clothes. Like, that's a – and Watterson's not bothered by that. I don't think we should be bothered by that. So all that to say, Coyle, I will join you in the I don't think there's anything inappropriate here. It's just a natural, normal six-year-old boy's mind as interpreted by Bill Watterson.
Right.
Take that, Facebook group.
To be clear, I was raised in a fundamentalist Baptist environment. So, I mean, even there was one really funny cartoon that made me laugh out loud with Calvin and Hobbes trying to figure out why tigers have tails. And they eventually settle on them just being purely decorative and you know, not really having a function. And Calvin says, so like a necktie for your butt, which, you know, even in the environment in which I was raised, at least the school environment, my family was more chill. I feel like I've got to defend ourselves. Even the word butt would be like an issue. But I imagine if you're that sensitive, you're probably not listening to City of Man.
So, right.
We might have just wasted 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
That's right. Yeah. Again, nobody in this group is ever going to hear this. So, you know, that's fine. Well, let's turn to some of the stuff that Watterson deals with. I guess before we do that, we should talk a little bit about Watterson himself. As Jordan pointed out, he's sort of notoriously reclusive. And I think that's probably to his credit. I can't imagine. Yep. We would be served at all by him spending more time in the public eye, and I can't imagine it'd be good for him either. But one of the things he talks about extensively in several volumes, but especially in the 10th anniversary book, is his battles with the Syndicate. Do either of you want to summarize that, or do you want me to?
I haven't read that recently enough to. I remember he had battles with the Syndicate, but I'd say take it away, Coyle.
Yeah. So kind of the two-tiered fight he had with the three-tiered fight he had with the company with whom he had signed a contract, right? So the way to sort of make it as a cartoonist, and this is everything I know about cartooning, but the way to make it is to get a syndicate deal, which then distributes your cartoons, as I understand it, as part of a package. Like, so it goes with a bunch of other cartoons to newspapers all around the country, and I assume now to websites. I'm assuming that there's an electronic component of that now as well, although, again, I don't know for sure. Well, the syndicate wanted, of course, regular production, which meant basically daily production, including color cartoons for Sundays, cartoons that, and this is kind of the second tier, that had, at the time he started, the Sunday cartoons had super strict spacing requirements, to the point where something like a third of the whole cartoon had to be a throwaway, something or other, like it couldn't be connected to the rest of it, because some Sunday cartoons, some Sunday editions would cut out the top third of the comic. And then kind of the third tier was licensing and merchandising. So putting Calvin and Hobbes on T-shirts, a TV show of some kind, all of the stuff that every other cartoonist is kind of their dream, because that's where the money really pours in. And Watterson, even though he'd signed the contract, and even though, you know, in the most technical sense, the syndicate had the right to sort of get their way on all of it, Watterson resisted. He said no to all of the merchandising. And my understanding is all of the merchandising, right? Other than the collections of the books. No T-shirts, no TV show, nothing. And then he fought with the syndicate and then with the newspapers over that spacing, and eventually won all of it. Eventually talked them into renegotiating a contract, which I assume he has to have been, if not the most popular cartoonist in America, in the top ones. Otherwise, there's no way he ever would have won that. Although, again, that's outside of my field. Did I miss anything with his battle there with the syndicate?
I think that's pretty much got it. He did, as far as I know, sign off on two licensed, like officially licensed items, mm-hmm. which was there were two calendars, and I think they were just like 12-month calendars. And there was some kind of like teacher's instructional book. Like I've seen it variously referred to as some kind of tutorial, but I think it was like a guide for teachers on how just kind of how to teach that had Calvin and Hobbes cartoons and illustrations in it. You can find some pictures of these things online. But otherwise, as he says, I can't remember which, I think it was in some of the essays, the 10th anniversary essays. He said, only pirates and vandals have ever made any money off of Calvin and Hobbes advertising, something like, or licensing, something like that.
The first time I ever visited DC, there was a little street vendor with the cart with the Calvin dancing to the record with the music going t-shirts.
Yeah,
that you could have picked up, and then various, you know, FBI with Calvin and sunglasses, and I mean, someone was making money off of that, and apparently it wasn't Bill Watterson.
Coyle, the only thing I'd add is that I remember the first time I read that essay. After I read that essay, I read the Sunday strips differently. So like this time, going back in the omnibus edition, like you can tell every one of those Sunday strips. It's just got like it's which is itself, I mean, part of the art. It's almost like two strips in one. But then you get to volume three of the omnibus edition and suddenly the Sunday strips are totally different. They're much more complex. They're a you get a whole world in there. And so, I mean, you can just see his own artistry in a different way with that backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say that weirdness where, maybe an analog would be the way some TV channels, in order to squeeze in more movies, have actually started experimenting with playing them at like 1.1 speed so that everything is like slightly sped up so they can like squeeze in one more movie during the day and a couple more commercial breaks. Newspapers were doing that. And I noticed this as a kid because when we would travel or go somewhere and I got the comics section on a Sunday, I noticed that things were different. They'd be shorter or rearranged. This is why, if you look at them in, especially the early Sunday cartoons, there's that usually kind of a decorative, very wide frame that actually has Calvin and Hobbes in it, the title of the strip, and the next little square frame next to that. And it's almost like a cold open on a TV show where there's like one little throwaway gag in that, and then you get to the meat of the thing and the rest of the strip. And that's, if you've ever noticed that kind of rhythm to the jokes of the early Sunday strips, that's why. It's because sometimes that first little bit would just get chucked again in the interest of space by the whatever newspapers, and having to I can't imagine trying to produce something artistically coherent knowing that some of the people who hand it out are going to be chopping it up that way. So I get the frustration for sure.
And it did cost him, right, when he won. He lost newspapers that said, look, we can't follow this format. Or he kept newspapers and said, okay, half our Sunday page is going to be Calvin and Hobbes. There's some of the backstory for this. I think it makes Watterson himself personally interesting, that he was willing to go to bat for that. And then, that combined with the reclusiveness, I think just keeps him sort of perpetually fascinating. In terms of themes, there's a number of things that run through this, and just a few that the three of us have kind of settled on. And I think these are loosely in order from kind of least common to most common. But certainly a theme in running through his works is that of environmental beauty versus human ugliness. I don't want to say that this is an environmentalist work, because I think that in the 21st century has connotations that it may not have had in the 1980s and 90s. I think the term that would have been used back then, and the term that people I knew back in the West who were conservative but also cared about the environment, that fits Watterson pretty well, is conservationist. So there's and maybe that term's not in use anymore. I'll direct the listener to the Restoration podcast for more information on that, because this is by no means my specialty. But there is some idea that the natural world is really neat, And it's being ruined by thoughtless and greedy people. And we need to do something to conserve it. Now, it's not that heavy-handed much of the time, but every once in a while, Watterson will sort of punch you in the face with it. what did you guys think, Watterson, on environmental, on the environment versus people?
I think that's the conservationist language there is probably pretty helpful, because I think there's I remember something we talked about in Dr. Turner's class about he set the collection of Calvin and Hobbes we read in contrast to Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, and Swamp right. Thing is a bit more overtly environmentalist and kind of flirts with eco-terrorism. Like, Swamp Thing might summon the green and destroy your town. But that's not what Bill Watterson's doing. Calvin's dad works in the city. His dad kind of loves the outdoors. He at one point takes the family camping in this, like, great sequence where they go camping in a torrential downpour for a week. And the dad is just thrilled. Mom and Calvin, they're not having it. But and we see Calvin going through all of these scenes where he and Hobbes are riding the wagon through the woods, and they're just having complete, utter joy. In contrast to Calvin stuck in school in this kind of manufactured environment. So I think there's something there that I don't see Watterson necessarily rejecting the city, rejecting roads. He's not calling it. He's not like an early climate change activist. He's not foreshadowing Greta Thunberg or anything like that. What he wants us to do, I think, is just keep in mind that all of the if we call it social progress, if we're willing to use that term, it does come at a cost. And it comes at kind of losing some of the joy that as kids we can just go out and play in the woods and be happy with a stick and a stream. And somehow when we're adults, that never really occurs to us. And Watterson kind of plays with that loss of, well, I'm just going to go like be outside, and just being outside is somehow enough. One of the other places I saw that a lot of is in the TV scenes where mom will either push Calvin out, and then, or he'll like go in and he'll just like watch TV. And you see this contrast between him vegging in front of the TV versus the active enjoyment of nature with Hobbes playing outside. And so all of that, I think, is Watterson sort of calling us to conserve something that he sees as in danger of being lost. So, Jordan, what'd you make of that one?
That's an interesting angle. I'd honestly never really thought of. I mentioned earlier that I grew up in the woods. So, I mean, I really strongly identified with Calvin in that way. I mean, I would, you know, when we got home from school, I would, you know, watch Animaniacs and Batman the Animated Series and then spend the rest of the day outside. Yeah. this is that era. And I mean, just running up and down the hills into laurel thickets, you know, climbing up in rhododendron. I don't think I ever – no, I rode a wagon down a hill. I wouldn't recommend it. we never see the consequences of that really, for Calvin. It's for me, what has always appealed the most about Calvin and his environment is, it's like the woods is the place that he goes to just turn on his imagination. His imagination is always kind of about escape. But you get the fantasy sequences most clearly at home, inside the house, and at school. When he's in the woods, he's in the woods, and his imagination is running wild, but it doesn't really he has escaped at that point, so he's free. And, you know, his imagination is kind of matching the physical location that he's in. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I'm kind of piecing this together for the first time. So, I mean, yeah, the woods and the environment in particular as kind of places of imagination and spontaneity, but also where you can go to think. I mean, there's a very strong – it's, you know, I'm not saying anything original here, but there's a very strong meditative quality to all of his conversations with Hobbes that is even more clear to me now as an adult. So, you know, most famously, it's these impossibly verbose wagon rides down the hill over a cliff. But I mean, that replicates so totally the mental experience of just playing in the woods. And, you know, you're physically doing one thing and your mind is just working through everything else. You know, the imaginative world that you're creating and any any particular thing or problem you're working through mentally, it's this is the best. Calvin and Hobbes has, to me, always been kind of the best visual dramatization of that kind of thought process. The place you're supposed to think, school, is drudgery, but like cut loose into the environment, you know, where mankind was kind of supposed to be. It's almost like Calvin's Eden. He's more fully himself and more fully mentally alive. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah. I think so.
It strikes me as like we probably could figure out a way to read it in a sort of Rousseauian light with like a, but I don't think Watterson really goes there, because like Calvin is still Calvin. He's not like, he's not some kind of innocent. His, and maybe that's like, he's still just as violent and quirky and ready to leave the woods and go hit Susie with a water balloon. It's not like he's innocent in the woods, but there definitely is some kind of connection between his real essence and the woods. I think that's a good connection, Jordan.
Yeah, he could go there to, oh, sorry.
It's an essence that is obscured by technology and by all of the stuff that goes on in, you know, when the woods are clear cut and houses are built in.
Regimentation. And this is the first time I noticed this reading through. I didn't get through the whole collection, but I read some. The handful of references we get to Calvin's dad's job, it appears he's got some kind of office job in industry.
He's a patent attorney.
Okay. I didn't know it was that specific. Because the last one that I read that had any kind of specific mention of that had to do with some kind of patent violation involving the flanges on brake discs or something. So I mean, you get you know, the law, office work, and mass production, the heavy industry, all the kind of worst case scenarios for Calvin's future, right there in his dad. And so I think I can't remember which of y'all brought the dad in, but I mean, the fact that he escapes to nature still as an adult, it's like he's in many ways a grown up Calvin.
Yeah. I think in terms of the environmentalism, there are obviously some strips that are more heavy handed, and the one standalone strip I think of is one where Calvin and Hobbes are walking where they have clear cut some of the trees because they're going to put in a house, and they start talking about, well, how would people like it if, you know, animals came and bulldozed houses and planted a bunch of trees. And then the last panel is them realizing the keys aren't left in the bulldozer, so they can't follow through on that. And it's just phenomenal. But there's also the whole story arc that I think even one of the books was named after. The Weirdos from Another Planet book, where they decide the Earth is too polluted, so they're going to go to Mars. So they get in the wagon and take the wagon trip off the cliff that launches them to Mars. And the very first thing they do on Mars is litter, right? When they eat their lunch and eat the candy bar, and Calvin chucks the candy bar away, the wrapper away, and Hobbes immediately calls him out on it. And you don't get away from the problems of man just by going into nature, even though the problems of man can also spoil nature. Mm-hmm. So it's I don't know that Watterson's intentionally making all of those arguments, but I think it's really interesting to follow through with some of that. Anything else on the environment? Otherwise, we should keep moving through these.
His illustrations of the woods, I keep going back to the woods because that's what strikes me, but his illustrations of all the environments, but especially pristine natural environments, are beautiful. Yeah. He is a great artist, and those scenes are a lot more beautiful than they need to be, strictly speaking. So they're just nice to look at.
Yeah, the last I heard, and I don't know if he's still doing this or not, but he'd given up drawing cartoons to paint, like to work professionally as a painter. And I honestly, I don't know that I could picture stuff that he has painted other than Calvin and Hobbes prints, right? I'm sure he's obviously deeply talented. I just struggle to picture anything that he could produce because my sole exposure is through Calvin and Hobbes.
The Lazy Sunday book has a oil painting of a T-Rex and a Triceratops fighting on the back cover.
Yeah.
That's one of the only things like that I've seen, though.
Which is still very Calvin and Hobbes-y, right?
Yeah.
Well, we've already mentioned a little bit childish joy versus adult humdrum work. Anything you guys want to add on that? We've already sort of mentioned the school and his dad's a patent attorney and all of that. Anything else you guys want to bring in there?
I'll just mention that reading Calvin now from kind of this side of 8 years of being a teacher, it does give me a lot more sympathy for my poor students who in some cases are spending, I mean, it's very easy to spend 8 days or 8 hours a day sitting in a desk listening to an adult talk at you as a student. And it at least helps me be somewhat sympathetic that I need to find some ways for my students to be up and active, which is harder to do in the year of COVID tide. But when we can do that, it at least is kind of playing to that natural human impulse to be engaged and hopefully be creative and so on.
I recommend having them come to your house and like chop firewood, paint the fence.
I did that for a couple of college professors. That's yeah.
Anything else? Otherwise, we'll move on.
One of the things that I've always loved about Calvin is, again, this was me as a kid, just to a T, the daydreams as a means of escape, because school takes forever when you're that age. It feels like it's never going to end. And so, yeah, of course, I want to imagine stomping around Tokyo or, you know, the one that always comes to mind is blowing up a school with a missile, which would probably not get printed nowadays. I'm guessing even as over the top as it is, but just the way imagination can rescue you from even that dull drudgery. If you don't let the humdrum defeat you, if you don't let the humdrum defeat you, imagination is a key part of, you know, surviving that.
That imagination point would actually be kind of a good transition into that appearance of the adult reality versus kind of Calvin's imagination, which I think is probably the biggest theme in the book. So I guess now we're going out of order a little bit, especially if we do what Watterson specifically says we're not to do, and says that decide that Hobbes is a function of Calvin's imagination, and Watterson is clear in several of the collections. It is not the case that Calvin is just imagining Hobbes. Like, he doesn't want us to resolve that. Like, whether Hobbes is really alive or just his imagination, he wants that left in tension. And which, hey, that's fine. I can appreciate that. But clearly, the rest of the strip, right, is a contrast between Calvin's imaginative world and what's going on in the real world, whether it's Spaceman Spiff or the transmogrifier or the duplicator or any of the other things that that Calvin brings to life entirely in his mind, and then everyone around him has to try to deal with, everyone around him has to try to interact with somehow. So I guess do you guys have favorite imaginative Calvin things? Spaceman Spiff, a Stupendous Man, right? The transmogrifier, the duplicator, the sled and the wagon to some extent, although those are usually more reflective than imaginative, I think. The snowman, I mean, any number of things you could pick. Do you have favorites, and then thoughts on kind of the general point there?
The one that comes most immediately to mind is I think it's the transmogrifier that becomes a time machine when Calvin, like,
right,
turns the box around and relabels it.
Right, turns it upside down, yeah.
Yeah, and then but it's like, now this is a time machine, and in that sequence, they literally travel like an hour and a half into the future, and there's Calvin wants his future self to have done his homework, so he's going to go collect it from the future self. The future Calvin and the present Calvin go back to a middling Calvin at like 7:30 in the evening. Turns out that no one ever does the homework. Meanwhile, the future and present Hobbes have written an essay that includes a joke about just how terrible Calvin is because he's so lazy and doesn't do his homework. I just thought that was brilliant. I love kind of the simultaneous play with here's how the imagination can go in these different ways. But yeah, onto your second half of your question, Coyle, about the point, I think there's something there about the childish enchantment with the world and kind of the way kids aren't bothered yet by whether or not something is real. They may or may not have firm concepts of this is definitely a real person and that's an imaginary person. And Watterson kind of plays with that as if like that's something that we too would benefit from, kind of remembering that the world is more complex and more wonderful than we know.
And Jordan, how about you?
What was his private eye character? I'm blanking on the name.
Oh, Tracer Bullet? Was that
yes, it? Tracer Bullet. I had that same childish fascination with noir. I had never seen any noir movies or read any noir novels. I listened to a few old-timey radio shows, but that, you know, fedora and the turned-up trench coat with the collar turned up and everything. I can't even remember any of the Tracer Bullet stories in particular, but I really loved the atmosphere he created with his artwork in those cartoons. Because when I imagine myself as a detective, that is precisely what I imagine myself doing. The tough, hard-talking guy who had like a endless supply of bizarre similes. But I think for me, Spaceman Spiff, because as a kid I was obsessed with astronauts and traveling in space. I even tried at one point to come up with my own Spaceman Spiff character because I could not get enough of those cartoons. I wanted to draw my own, and I think his name was Commander Keen. Go figure. I think I got halfway through one comic and was like, I want to go outside. Maybe I'll revisit that one of these days. Probably not. Maybe we'll come back to this sled and the wagon stuff again. The snowmen. I always loved what he did with the snowmen. Maybe because growing up, I grew up in the South, but in the mountains where we actually got more snow, enough to be used to it in the winter, but never quite enough to do anything really cool with it. And was, jealous of those opportunities to sculpt these tableaux that Calvin did.
Did you guys notice the one strip where Calvin gets yelled at for trying to create an anatomically correct snowman?
Yeah.
I forgot about that one.
That one starts with Susie, and she's like, look, I made a clear snow woman, and it's obviously shapely. Well, Calvin is in, he goes and he tries to make something, and his mom just, you see this panel with like a perfect shocked mom, like, how on earth could my boy have done this? Like, just appalled look. I thought it was so perfect. I loved that one.
We need to come back to Susie. Just all the fantasy sequences in general, in addition to just the imaginative way Calvin makes use of everything in his environment, from the boxes with the labels and just turning them particular directions, to the wagon, to the sled, to the snow. I think a wonderful, it's a dramatization and an appreciation and a like a pion for childhood imagination can do. It never gets old as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I'm a fan of they're all really well done, which I think is a credit to Watterson as an artist, because when I think of those, I don't think of anything. I'm like, what a terrible idea. And that just fell flat. I tend to like the ones where the imagination and the real world have to sort of fight with each other a little
bit,
because in Calvin's mind, he's Spaceman Spiff, or he's Stupendous Man. I probably like the Stupendous Man ones best, where he is a superhero, but clearly not the good guy, right? I mean, there's rarely any doubt that he is doing the wrong stuff while in that costume. But then the teacher has to deal with it the time he takes it to school, or the babysitter, or Susie, or his mom, he's Spaceman Spiff and shooting his blaster at the blob monster, which is Susie Durkin's. I think that interaction is great.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting. So other works that are kind of dealing with that age will always want to turn the imagination into something functional, like something to help you get by in the real world. And I think of books and movies like A Bridge to Terabithia, right? Where it's clearly pro-imagination, right? It's not saying this is something that's just childish and you need to get rid of it, but it's also trying to turn imagination into a tool to help you better function in the real world in a way that Calvin's imagination, it helps him in that, I guess it passes time so he's not bored, but he is it is imagination for the sake of joy and not much else. And I think there's something that's kind of fun about that.
Well, it's something healthy too. I mean, not everything has to be, not everything has to have utility. I think again, I don't know how conscious this is on Watterson's part, but the contrast between the, you know, regimented, dull, gray, humdrum spaces of school especially, but other locations as well, and the freewheeling openness and joy of, again, the environment, I think that visually dramatizes that point. I mean, it's you, on one side you have the world of utility, and on the other side you have the world of joy. And Calvin's imagination most often helps him bring a little joy into the world of utility. But if he tried to make joy useful, it would kill it.
Which I think you guys have just given me words to figure out why I've always had trouble with Bridge to Terabithia, because I read that as a kid. And I remember reading that after I had read Chronicles of Narnia and thinking that it was going to be a similar story. But the problem with Bridge to Terabithia is that, like, the whole point is that it's a pretend make-believe world to cope with a real-world problem. It's not an actual world that the kids are in. But for Calvin, from his perspective, his imaginary world is perfectly real. I mean, it doesn't matter that it's pretend. There's not that division of pretend and reality for him. And like that certainly makes for a much better story. I would much rather have a story that is going to invoke an enchanted imaginary element and then treat that seriously, what Tolkien calls the secondary world with a ring of reality to it, as opposed to be like, aha, here is psychological theory 3.2. Let us now test whether grief should be dealt with the creation of an imaginary space. It just made for a terrible story. Anyway.
In mild defense of Bridge to Terabithia, it was young adult fiction written pre-Harry Potter. Like, you can't hold it to too high of a standard. Young adult fiction before Harry Potter was garbage. So, with exceptions, but not many.
Oh. Well, we should do a young adult literature episode one day. I don't know how that fits into the point of City of Man, but if you ever want to do a YA lit episode, I have to bring my wife on. She loves that stuff.
Everything is political. We can make it fit. We can regiment it and bring it in here.
Well, YA now is definitely political. So there you go.
Well, that's true. That's true. But again, it's also better than it was when we were growing up. I mean, the young adult world was a wasteland when we were, especially for Christians, right? If you had parents who were like, you're only going to read Christian stuff, the utter rubbish that was cranked out of those Christian presses.
Did either of y'all read the Goosebumps books?
Yep.
Okay.
Not all of them, but yeah.
So those were the books, like, my mom was sure those were, like, half demonic. I mean, like, it was, so. Anyway, that's a tangent.
We mentioned some – sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do we want to specifically talk about the Hobbes thing?
I mean, Watterson doesn't want us to.
Okay. I will say, to your point about the world being perfectly real for Calvin and how reflective that is for childhood imagination – I remember when I think one of my cousins was the first one to point out that whenever there was another person in the scene, Hobbes became a stuffed animal. And I had never noticed that. I had never noticed it. It had completely, and that actually bothered me. I remember being upset and having to, I think the way I eventually squared the circle was that it was basically like Toy Story, where that was kind of Hobbes's disguise when other people were around. I respect Watterson not, leaving some things mysterious and ambiguous. It would be very unlike him to draw a clear, create a spreadsheet to map Calvin's imagination onto. So kudos to him. But yeah, I, I, t- to your point, I never noticed as a kid until someone pointed it out to me, which I think says something.
Because I read those scenes differently than that. I mean, I kind of saw that as like, I'm thinking of the scene, there's one strip where Calvin is looking at he's looking out the window, it's raining, he and Hobbs go out together to the bus stop, and Calvin gets on the bus and like he waves goodbye to Hobbs. And then you get Hobbs out in the rain as a stuffed tiger, and the mom sees the stuffed tiger, she brings him in, and then you see Hobbs at the window looking out for Calvin, and Calvin stuck in school looking out the window for Hobbs. I read that as like what you're seeing there is like Watterson is kind of carefully giving us two very different perspectives at the exact same time. Yeah. So like you see the adult perspective, you see Calvin's perspective doesn't change because Calvin always thinks everyone has heard what Hobbs has said or seen what Hobbs has done. Meanwhile, mom is like washing Hobbs in the dryer and like Hobbs comes out like super fluffy as if like they're both there at the same time. So yeah, I like what you said about the mystery and ambiguity. Like Watterson's trying to like do both of those.
Yeah. And I didn't say it. It was Watterson.
Yeah, because he said almost exactly what you said about the dueling perspectives in one of these essays, where he's just presenting two realities, basically two perspectives on reality, and just kind of leaving it to us, which I kind of wish we had more of nowadays. I know I dump on it all the time, but that kind of internet nerd culture that has to have everything squared away and explained personally drives me crazy, and it's uncreative. And Watterson is kind of an example of the right way to do it.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about boys and girls. We've mentioned Susie as Calvin's counterpoint, I guess, someone who theoretically could inhabit the same imaginative world with him, because they are both children, but also obviously can't, because she's weird and gross. and she's not the only girl in this, right? There's also, of course, Calvin's mom and Rosalyn, who I think is the only person that, comes close to being in Calvin's world, right? Rosalyn is the one who kind of figures it out a little bit in the last book in the Magical World book, where he talks her into playing Calvin ball. But so boys and girls, what do we learn about gender relationships in Calvin and Hobbes?
Well, since I am not in the formal academy and probably never will be, because I've already said enough things on the internet that I doubt anyone would ever hire me anywhere for an academic post, I'll just go on record as saying I find it very refreshing to read somebody who is perfectly happy to have a boy be a boy and a girl be a girl and have them both think they are completely different species and are icky and gross and not make any apologies for that. I think we see that most clearly in Calvin's club, the get rid of slimy something, whatever it spells out gross. Like
get rid of slimy girls, right?
Well, that doesn't spell out gross.
S at the end of girls is the other S.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay, yeah.
And then, which the real problem there, he thinks, is it's redundant.
right. But then you see like that contrasted with scenes of Susie's tea parties, and you just see them playing in different ways. Susie is similar to Calvin. She has Mr. Bun, but Mr. Bun is a herbivore. Is we don't see Mr. Bun lively like the tiger. I mean, like clearly a bunny fits a girl and a tiger fits a boy. And just kind of seeing their interactions, Calvin is plotting games of war. Susie now, but at the same time, I think Watterson is also he clearly makes Susie smarter than Calvin. Like so if there is a gender comparison, girls are smarter than boys and boys are more violent than girls. It just seeing that and their interactions, it gives it. I think it resonates. It fits the actual small children that I know. In a way that if anyone actually wrote this story today, the Twitter mob would be after them so fast.
Yeah, although your point about violence, I'd have to go back and look. Susie can hold her own even physically against Calvin. Right? he gets her with snowballs quite a bit, but she might get him more. Again, I'd have to go and count them up, like how many times she wins. I don't know.
That's fair.
Yeah, I really like what you just said about that. It is very refreshing to revisit these things and see, you know, just what I see with my kids, you know, in comic form. The relationship that Susie and Calvin have is really similar to the way my daughter and my oldest boy act with each other. They're only 2 years apart. And my son is now old enough to really give her a lot of trouble. he's sly and mischievous, and he's more chaotic. She plays in a very orderly way, likes her Legos, and, you know, sets up her, she's got Lego Disney princesses and sets them up in, you know, parties and get togethers and all kinds of sleepovers and stuff. And my son is a wrecking ball. I mean, you know, he's, you know, got that crazy Calvin energy. It's just, I lived through childhood. I can't deny what it's like. This is how boys and girls generally interact with each other at this age, for sure. And it's portrayed, not, like you said, without apology and with a great deal of affection. Like, it's not like one of them is bad and the other is good. They are different and complementary. And Watterson himself said that he kind of designed their relationship where it's like they've got this weird frenemy thing. You know, they're attracted to each other and also repel each other. He said, you know, they don't really understand what's going on. And he said he thinks that's the way it is with a lot of relationships. But they are at base friends of one kind or another, as evidenced by the fact that they keep, you know, in some regard, are playing with each other. I think my absolute favorite Susie cartoon is a Sunday strip done in a really dramatic, like, serious cartoon style, you know, like Mary Worth or something, Judge Parker, where they're playing house. So Calvin's having to play her game. And so they're illustrated like this very serious looking, finely drawn couple. It's got this line that stayed with me. Calvin is refusing to play by her rules, and at some point he's drawn as an adult man with a suit and tie and a pipe, he's like pointing and saying, "No, this is idiotic. I refuse." whenever I'm not wanting to go along with something, somewhere in the back of my mind, that frame pops into my head. I don't know what you can necessarily learn from it, but again, I don't think Watterson's purpose in any of this is didactic. He's taking something that really happens and affectionately exaggerating it, in both a pretty clear-eyed look, just kind of an examination, but also, just kind of an appreciation. There's something very appreciative about everything he illustrates, which, you know, there's a love in what he does that, I think is one of the reasons his work has lasted.
Well, anything else on, Boys and Girls? Otherwise, we will we'll move on to Good and Evil.
I think we'd both like you to say something really clearly controversial, so you're the one everybody gets mad at.
I'll think about that, and if I think it's something, I might splice it in. But I also give my wife kind of absolute veto power over what actually posts, so there's no promise it would stay there anyway.
That's a good rule.
I'm sure it's saved my job multiple times.
There's one scene where I remember Calvin leaning over to Susie and asking her for the answer on the test. Yes. And it's a math test, and she tells him some history fact, like it was the battle of such and such. He's like, "Wait, it's a math test." She's like, "No, it's a trick answer." And then he's like, "But why aren't you writing it down?" She's like, "Oh, is that way I don't want the teacher to think that I cheated off of you." And Calvin's like, "All right." And she totally gets it. I just love that moment.
Yeah, Calvin, for all of his imaginative power, right, struggles a little bit with the intellectual life. You know, because he's six or seven or however old he's supposed to be. The thing that we see Calvin doing most when he is not in his imaginative world, or dealing with Susie or Rosalind or his parents, is sort of reflecting on good and evil, free will, providence, right? All of the things that I'm sure 6 and 7 year olds reflect on. All right. And this is where the wagon and the sled really come in. Because as I think Watterson points out in one of the essays he writes, just Calvin on a sled or Calvin in a wagon would be boring, but you throw this stuff in and all of a sudden the scenery and the reflections work together in a way that maybe they shouldn't, but they do. What is good and evil in the world of Calvin and Hobbes? I mean, kind of my takeaway on that was, evil is clearly found in human beings, right? It's clearly Calvin himself does awful things, I don't want to say he is sheer evil, but he is clearly fallen, even as he is as innocent as kids are in many, many ways. He is also clearly fallen, but so are his parents. So is Miss Wormwood. So is Susie. So is Rosalind. And so, as we've seen earlier when we were talking about the environment, so is sort of civilization in general, right? It's this attack on the natural world. So it's tempting then to say, well, good is the natural world, but we start looking at Hobbes, and all of a sudden, Hobbes is also violent, and Hobbes is perfectly willing to eat things, and the natural world is also kind of destructive. It's really interesting, and maybe more subtle than Watterson intended. Maybe I'm reading more into this than it should be there. Anyway, thoughts on this?
I don't know that I have I don't see a clear answer to your question in their conversation. So as the strips I'm thinking of, and maybe I didn't read, maybe there's more that do this more clearly I haven't reread that I'm not thinking of, but the ones that I reread, Calvin doesn't really ever answer the questions he raises. It seems to me that he raises this question of like, wow, isn't there evil in the world? And it's not like he then proposes, therefore, we need to pass this policy to change structural evil, or therefore, we should just all die so that we people don't infect the planet. It's like he just leaves it hanging there with this implication that, of course, there's evil. Let's think about this. But then he himself enjoys the mischievous or evil things that he does. And when he thinks about goodness, he connects goodness with boredom. Like being good is somehow just this dull drudgery. He will never get to do what he desires kind of thing. But he also
or getting presents, right? He also connects it with getting presents from Santa.
Which that's but even that, I mean, like I remember there's one comic where he talks about he and Hobbes are talking about heaven and hell. And he makes some reference to hell, and Hobbes' response is, well, maybe you're probably going to be there. But then he talks about heaven is like, maybe heaven is the place where you get to do whatever you want, as if like that was the ultimate good that he can imagine. And so good is simultaneously satisfying his desires and getting material stuff. Also getting to watch as much TV as he wants and never going to school. I think those might make up his notion of the good, but I don't know, I don't know if Watterson's trying to like answer the question of what is good or what is evil as much as take sort of the popular level philosophical discussions or the perennial philosophical discussions that start in antiquity and kind of situate those in like the modern day and sort of use those to spark thoughts. But I think he's a bit more Socratic in that result. He's not answering any of those questions.
Yeah, I think Socratic is the right word for it. Yeah, I don't remember any of those discussions ever having clear answers that were not just punchlines. Coyle, I liked your point about how no matter where Calvin goes, you know, there he is. it's regardless of the humdrum of school or the beauty of nature, Calvin takes his sin nature with him wherever he goes, which I think to your point is a anti-Rousseau kind of vision. He's not purified by being in a particular place, whether that's through the rigor and discipline of school or from, you know, the kind of state of nature that he's in when he's in the woods. What's definitely deficient is Calvin's sense of the good, but I think there we have to, you know, fall back. Watterson has said in interviews that one of the reasons he enjoys writing Calvin is that he often disagrees with Calvin. Calvin's saying things that he's just kind of working through, but that Watterson himself doesn't really endorse. And I think maybe whenever Calvin is reflecting on heaven being, you know, where there's no rules anymore or whatever, or especially his concern with, you know, getting rewarded for good behavior, I think there we're really clearly supposed to remember that he's six. And this is definitely the moral code of my two older children. You know, and that's why they got to keep growing and maturing.
Although the conversation where he's, you know, thinking about getting presents versus throwing the snowball at Susie, right, is always the counterpoint. I really want to do this, but if I do, Santa's going to withhold presents. he also makes the point that, well, if I don't throw the snowball, but I only don't throw it because I want presents, that doesn't really count as being good. And then I think Susie ends up hitting him with a snowball in that one, although I don't remember the specifics now. And they settle on, well, at least I was worried about it. That's got to be good enough, right?
Yeah, just raising the questions is, you know, at least you're not Mo, right? Who just right. He Mo is man in a state of nature, just, you know, nasty, brutish, and short, to quote the other Hobbes.
Right.
So we probably should keep in mind too the genre and the form does not lend itself to lengthy ethical, moral, philosophical considerations. I mean, Watterson has at most 45 seconds to kind of make his punchline. I mean, that's I think, Coyle, we were talking earlier about the philosophical sitcom, I'm blanking on the name, The Good Place.
The Good Place.
And, I mean, it's like that line from Chidi, everyone hates moral philosophy or moral philosophers. I think part of what Calvin does that is really enduring is just the we all resonate with Calvin to some extent. I mean, we hopefully remember those times when we really wanted to do the wrong thing. We knew what the right thing was. And that if Watterson's going for anything, I think that's probably the extent of what he's going for. He wants just to kind of spark that memory and maybe even raise a question. But I don't see him trying to intentionally, like, this is not a philosophical discourse hidden in a Sunday comic strip.
Right. Although, I mean, you're right, the 45 seconds, but this strip ran for however many years. Mm. So 45 seconds a day stretched over, and you can see the maturation of the strip as a whole, but also of these conversations. By the time you get from that first Calvin and Hobbes collection to the final It's a Magical World that the syndicate made him put out, because he had another book left on his contract, there's clear development of some kind there. I don't know what it is because I haven't read it in that sense, but at least there's a deepening of the thought, right? There, mm-hmm. There's a more nuanced reflection than there is at the beginning, and someone should write a book on that, but not me. I just enjoy it. Well, there's a lot more that we could talk about, but we've been talking for an hour already, so let's just go around real quick and share what your favorite strip is. If you can possibly pick one, mine, and I'll post links to all of these in the show notes. Mine is one that probably has no meaningful value. It hits me every time. And I think I shared this on your Facebook timeline, Josh, but it's a strip where, Calvin and Hobbes are like, Valentine's Day is coming up and Hobbes starts teasing Calvin about liking Susie, and Calvin just goes absolutely ballistic. Like, it is such a phenomenally well-timed meltdown. Like, it's kind of Homer Simpson's explosions at its best, except in Calvin. And the end of the strip is Susie shows up and reveals that, in fact, Calvin had sent her a Valentine. And it was like a bouquet of dead flowers and a poem about how much he hates her. But it was still a Valentine. So Hobbes then has even more ammo to use. And it's just such a well-timed thing. Anyway, that's mine. Not philosophically deep at all. Just I think phenomenally funny. What do you guys have?
One that struck me, at least as I was reading through these this time, there were a few that I was just like, I have to take a picture of these, this one, and share. So I'm just pulling from one of those. This is where Calvin fills up a water balloon, and he then announces to the universe this line: In order to determine if there is any universal moral law beyond human convention, I have devised the following test. I will throw this water balloon at Susie Durkins unless I receive a sign within the next 30 seconds that this is wrong. Of course, he does not receive a sign. He does, in fact, hit Susie with the water balloon. She then beats him up, and he he then concludes from this, why does the universe always give you the sign after you do it? Maybe this is just because I read this right after teaching Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative to my 11th graders, but this seemed to be seemed to sum up so much of real moral theory in a great picture. We might ask for all these signs. We really know what's right and what's wrong. And then when we do the wrong thing, life punishes us. And we're like, wait a minute, where's the sign? I just love Calvin's conclusion. The universe gave him a sign. It was just a little delayed.
Jordan, what do you got?
Oh, man, I have a hard time picking. I love the Valentine one you mentioned, especially the big googly eyes that Hobbes gives Calvin, which is what finally sends him over the edge. I like any of the ones where Calvin is imagining himself either blown up to gigantic size or shrunk. And, you know, there's one where he's a fly in the house. There's another where he's like a quarter of an inch tall. And so he's walking across pennies and has to climb up on his dad's camera and try to take his own picture. Because I used to fantasize about exactly that stuff. Like if I was microscopic, how would I get out of here? Yeah, this probably doesn't have any deeper meaning, but the one where he has a snowball that he's kept in the freezer since winter, and you know he's like, Susie's yes. Never going to know what hit her, like, you know, a snowball in the middle of July. That's such a fun idea, and I thought of that every time it snowed as a kid. I thought about trying to save a snowball just because I didn't even have anybody I wanted to hit with it. But just that is something a child would think of. That is something a child would think was cool, which I absolutely did. But it is also something your mom is almost certainly going to throw out the next day.
Yeah, so, it doesn't work, in case you're wondering. Two failed experiments. Either someone will throw it out, or it just turns into a clump of ice.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
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 But it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's we'll have to stop there, because otherwise we'll just keep going, and obviously all of us enjoy Calvin and Hobbes because we are not joyless monsters. If you also are not a joyless monster listener, please let us know what your favorite strips are and other themes, ideas that you see running through Calvin and Hobbes as well. And guys, thanks for coming on the show. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.